The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at www.nsa.edu.
Well, welcome everyone to our Grad Forum / Wendon lecture. I'd like to welcome Dr. Michael Lynch, who is a student of eminent historical theologian Dr. Richard Muller. Michael is a friend of mine. I've followed his work for some time, does remarkable stuff, and is specializes in Reformed scholasticism of the 17th century, especially, and also some of the hot topics therein. He is known for having online lectures that he did in a live forum about hypothetical universalism and how much more common that kind of view of atonement was in the 17th century than it later became as the Reformed tradition bottlenecked. Although, as we're going to discover from Dr. Lynch, I think the breadth of opinion survived surprisingly long, and in some very surprising places. Mm-hmm. And the trick is really, you know, learning how to know what to look for. So, without any more further ado, let's welcome Dr. Michael Lynch. Michael, tell us about what is the difference between our current perceptions, broadly speaking, of the acceptable diversity of Reformed theological opinion now? And of course, there are several, there are different venues, different, you know, circles, different denominational groups. But broadly speaking, compare our current view of what the parameters are to, say, the 17th century.
Yeah, I think that it kind of depends who you talk to or what historians you have in mind who deal with the Reformed tradition and their perceptions of how broad or narrow the Reformed tradition really is. You know, you think of someone like R. Scott Clark at Westminster Seminary in California. You know, his view of Reformed orthodoxy is basically nonconformist Presbyterianism and the Westminster Confession of Faith in particular, or, you know, maybe the three forms of unity. But it's also oftentimes, you know, his interpretation. My orthodoxy basically becomes Reformed orthodoxy instead of allowing Reformed orthodoxy to set the agenda of what is allowed for my orthodoxy. So I think the perspective that you take on the question often determines how you're going to perceive either diversity or commonality in the early modern.
So Reformed orthodoxy it's not just a dogmatic term, it's also, and maybe preeminently now, a historical term.
Yeah.
How do we, what are the criteria for determining Reformed orthodoxy? Who gets to use that? What historical donkey is that tail being pinned on?
Right? Yeah. Generally my answer to that question is, if the question is, what is orthodox for someone to hold today, then ultimately that's going to be determined by synods and whether or not, you know, something is deemed acceptable or unacceptable in the OPC or PCA. Now, if you're asking the question, what was considered to be within the bounds of Reformed orthodoxy in the early modern period, my general rule is take all the major Reformed confessions from all the different regions, German-speaking, French-speaking, English-speaking, throughout, you know, from, you know, the kind of early part of the confessionalization period of, you know, 1560 onwards, including the Westminster Confession of Faith as being kind of one of the last, like, great bastions of kind of Reformed orthodoxy, an expression of Reformed orthodoxy. Take all of those. And I think what you'll see is that there's similar threads in all of them. And Charles Hodge, this is in an article that he has in the 19th century, he wrote in the Princeton Review. He has this article on confessionalism and confessional subscriptionism. And his view of confessionalism was basically that there's kind of this center of, there's always been this kind of center of Reformed Orthodoxy. And he basically said that what Reformed Orthodoxy is, confessionally speaking, is that which separated you from the various other confessional, either Protestant or Roman Catholic groups, right? So it's having a Reformed view of the Lord's Supper as opposed to a Roman Catholic view of the Lord's Supper, or Lutheran,
right.
You know, baptism, taking all the different loci and saying that there's that the Reformed identified themselves, now not wholly, but generally speaking, against other traditions. And there's commonality, of course, doctrine of God. Right. I mean, there's not a lot of disagreement on, you know, the immutability of God. And so there's going to be some commonality that we have with Roman Catholics or Lutherans or any other Protestant group. And so I think the rule for me is take those areas that are that you find kind of common among all of those different confessions, Reformed confessions, and that to me is what kind of Reformed Orthodoxy is all about.
Okay, so is that a kind of an inductive process that we do now in retrospect, or was it something that that those generations were themselves distinctly aware of?
Oh, I think they kind of, I haven't come across any explicit thing like that, but I think that they definitely have a sense of identifying themselves against other positions, right? That there's this reform, there's a particular reform position against the remonstrant position on on a particular topic, right? Or against the Lutherans on a particular topic, namely the sacraments or Christology, and against the Roman Catholics on certain issues as well, like justification. And so, and those are those common threads that you just find in all the confessions.
So these common loci that you think the Reformed theologians of the 17th century were perfectly aware of, this set of common principles.
Totally.
And could self-identify, if someone said, what makes you Reformed as opposed to Lutheran or Roman Catholic, they could do the same thing. So this is not simply an inductive construct of modern.
Yeah, and they would have recognized that various regions have various peculiar Reformed distinctives. So Sabbatarianism in England, for instance, the Dutch they call it the English doctrine of Sabbatarianism. Like that's actually what they called it, right? They saw it as a particularly English thing. They even saw that there was intra-Reformed differences. I mean, Episcopalianism, of course, is naturally English as well, as opposed to German or French or something like that. So I think they all intuitively seem to recognize that.
So how did the bottlenecking that results, you just gave an example, I won't repeat the name, how did the bottlenecking happen where someone could say, take a very simplistic reading of John Owen and say, this is all there is?
Yeah, I think the loss of Latin, where the canon from which we're drawing to understand Reformed theology narrows to a large degree. We simply are unable to get a lot from German-speaking Reformed theology in the early modern period, or from French, because little of that has been translated into English. And so eventually when those languages are lost, Latin especially, but even German itself or French itself, you're just losing.
Anglophones.
Huh?
Lost for Anglophones.
Yeah, lost, yeah, yeah. And I'm thinking particularly in an American context, of course.
Right.
And then just the fact that who wins out, right? Anglicanism moves in a kind of non-reformed direction eventually, and therefore all you're left with, if you're reformed, is basically non-conformity, Presbyterianism, Congregationalism. And so who are you going to read? Presbyterians or Congregationalists? And so I think it's just kind of a natural thing. And then, you know, even modern publishers have a lot to do with that, particularly in America. I mean, Banner of Truth, whom they publish, what they publish, right, has a lot to do with that. I think we just underestimate the power of publishing. Who has the power gets to have the say on who's important and who's not.
Yeah, and with Banner of Truth, of course, I mean, I think we're all very grateful for what they've done.
But they,
for obvious reasons, prefer English language devotional literature,
yep,
because they didn't have a large kind of core of translators who, mm-hmm, could be, you know,
right,
translating these great dogmatic works of the 17th century. And it's still a very difficult task. I was just looking at I'm sure you've seen this the website of this guy who's translating Damour's commentary on Marcius.
Okay.
And he's doing this alone. I mean, yeah, he's just got this, you know, or seems to be doing it alone, which is, you know, a kind of heroic but very difficult task. So,
yeah,
talk a little more then about the politics of, let's call it, you know, sort of trademarking in the 20th century, just in the American scene. You know, who gets to, you said, who wins? So, you know, I think that whomever wins gets to sort of own the brand, right?
Yeah.
They have Presbyterian.com.
Yeah.
They got the domain name first. So, can you talk a little bit about the politics of monopoly of names in the 20th century? I mean,
yeah,
it's related to that question of publication, but.
Yeah, I mean, even the question of who became the standard textbook in 19th century American theological seminaries that taught Reformed theology. Who is it? I mean, it's Turretin.
Yeah.
Turretin has his own flavor of Reformed theology.
Yeah.
And that, not surprisingly, becomes kind of the benchmark for what becomes Reformed, right? So when he goes after the Sumerians at the Academy of Sumer in France, and treats them fairly unorthodox, though of course he actually calls them brothers at times,
right,
and
right,
these sorts of things,
he
right?
He doesn't actually unchurch them.
Right, he does not unchurch them,
nervous.
although people that, you know, love Turretin would like to do that.
What's that line of Dr. Muller's that, you know, amoralism might make one raise one eyebrow, I think it's something like that.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
the remonstrance, both eyebrows go up.
Yeah,
you can see Turretin's one eyebrow,
yeah,
being raised,
exactly,
in the case of somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think, again, but that's the canon narrowing, right? The canon just narrows. Instead of all these other commonplace textbooks that would have been used and would have been well known, it just eventually, one's knowledge of early modern Reformed Orthodoxy became nothing more than Francis Turretin. And Turretin's relatively late on the scene. I mean, he's really late, actually. There had been 150 years of Reformed Orthodoxy before he got on the scene, and so.
Do you think that with Turretin, like with Machen later, who I think is probably himself also inadvertently responsible for a certain bottlenecking of our understanding of Reformed tradition, is it because they were victors not so much over other Reformed positions, but over liberalism? So Turretin is dealing with,
sure,
kind of a nascent liberalism, kind of a proto-enlightenment of his time, and he really, you know, he vindicates the Reformed faith in the field,
yeah,
and he's received very widely as this kind of paladin because he went out and he did it, right? And likewise,
right,
Machen makes,
yeah,
the big exodus, he risks a lot personally, he has been taking a stand for years, making these kind of, you know, being the Cassandra of the Reformed world, saying, I see all this coming, and then it's validated, and he says, you know, here I am.
Yeah.
And I think, of course, you know, without, you don't need to read any ego into that at all, I think quite the opposite. You know, these men were devoted to the faith, but
yes.
Do you think it's the laurels they got for being triumphant over sort of episodes of liberalism that have made people sort of latch onto their works as sort of unusually preeminent?
Absolutely, and there's nothing new about it, right? I mean, I just recently finished, you know, Brad's little retranslation of Hooker.
Oh, right.
Right? And Hooker makes almost that same point in the preface of why Puritanism has been so, or, you know, why early Puritanism at least.
Disciplinarianism, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, had been so, why people had been so drawn to it. It's because they seem to be on the right side of Jesus, right? Like, they're the ones trying to uphold, go back to the Bible. You know, it's kind of this biblicism going on with some of the Puritans.
Very strong in works of mercy.
Yeah,
preaching.
Exactly. That is fighting liberalism, right? Fighting liberalism, maybe Arminianism, even I speak anachronistically,
yeah.
Of course, with Hooker, right? Of course, in that time period, but still. Those sorts of doctrines. I think that that's right. And I don't think it's new. I think that that's an old kind of. We like those that defend very rigorously our views. We're attached to them, and that's part of the reason why Davenant, I don't think, has been received in stronger reform circles, because there's always a moderate tone to him. He's cold. The number one adjective used in the early modern period of Davenant is judicious. Judicious. It's not feisty. It's not bombastic. It's not strong-willed. It's judicious. He just isn't always blasting Roman Catholics.
He'll always make a distinction.
Yeah, yeah, he's just...
Without compromising.
Yeah, exactly, and he's... He just doesn't have that temperament that the Owens, the Baxters even... why was Baxter beloved so much? I mean, it was because he's just as feisty as Owen, right? That's why both of them were beloved in that period. It's because they were both super feisty folk who went after everything that they disliked as much as possible. And Davenant just wasn't like that. He only felt like he needed to enter into debates that were essential to some gospel issue or something. And so I think that that's part of it.
Yeah, because one thing I found in various interactions is that you'll be talking with people about the Reformed tradition in the 20th and 21st century. You can give certain examples of this or that case, and they'll say, oh, well, that's not really Reformed. There's kind of a trademarking maneuver that goes on.
Oh, yeah.
I remember having a conversation with Reformed historian, and I said, well, you know, Episcopacy is compatible with the Reformed position. It was in England, and you get a few funny little experiments elsewhere, in Germany. And I said, but, you know, the currently existing example is the Church of Hungary. Hmm. And this person said, well, they're not really, you know, I don't want to say what he's. I don't want to put words in his mouth. But as I recall, he said something like, "Well, that part's not really reformed, or you know, that's the thing that they do.
Yeah.
But you know, they're reformed otherwise." I forget exactly how it went.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you see this kind of thing all the time, yep. And people seem to be quite comfortable just saying, "Look, maybe there was a greater historical diversity, and there might even be a greater dogmatic and practical diversity than we want to recognize now." But we're considering. Kind of the case has been closed on this. We're just going to call this reformed, and nothing else gets to be called reformed. Talk a little bit about the kind of the dialectical problem of dealing with that and engaging with that in a brotherly
way. Yeah, there is a Hegelian sort of kind of view that we're moving towards greater. You know, like you'll often hear. I've often heard folks say, "Well, it was okay to not." To have some disagreement over that subject back then.
Right.
But today, you know, we've kind of advanced,
right.
You know, we've entered into some age of advancement where, you know, while it was okay to be reformed and hold to episcopacy back then, we've now realized that, some sort of Presbyterianism is the only model, straight down from heaven and...
Except considerably modified.
Yes, indeed, because it's not establishment principle.
Right.
It looks nothing like what Samuel Rutherford would have wanted from...
Or even what existed in Geneva.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. It looks nothing like Calvin's Geneva. So, exactly. And so, there is that sort of kind of view of history where, you know, we've kind of advanced from those differences, but I just typically have a, this is a Mueller thing too, I just typically have a more negative view of the present than the past. I just think those people were actually more sophisticated. And I just think we've just kind of simplified issues. And then because we've simplified the issues, we've thought that we've arrived. When in fact, when the issues were known to be more complicated, you had more diversity. And they had worked through things a lot more carefully and therefore disagreed a lot more.
No argument for me on that one. I use HEPA as a textbook in the systematics course here, and it's remarkable how often in HEPA he'll be citing some doctor, and the doctor will say, well, the Reformed generally hold this, except for so-and-so who holds this other thing. And there's no sense that this person is being excommunicated, there's no bell booking candle. It's just, well, we're not entirely, this is a minor thing, it's a peripheral point, or maybe it's more contested, but it's certainly not an essential thing. And this guy reads it this way, and that's how that is.
Yeah.
Right? And it's remarkable how often that happens, and no one seems to be in a panic about it. It's just there's this broad consensus, then there are these moments of differentiation, and people are like, oh yeah, well, brother so-and-so holds this thing, and there we are.
Yeah,
we're moving on. It's not. Yeah. It's no longer an issue.
Well, I mean, Fuchsius. I'm going to bring this up tomorrow in my lecture, but Fuchsius, when he gets to the extent of the atonement section of his disputations, he first goes after the remonstrants, and then he gets to he asks the question all over again, and then he said the very first thing he says. So he asks the question whether Christ died for all or for the elect alone. And then his answer, the very first sentence that comes out of his mouth is the Reformed or the Orthodox is what he calls, you know, he just means the Reformed, differ on this.
Right.
And then he lays out three different views. Right. And if you read that first view in particular, you would think to yourself, I mean, if I went before Presbytery today and just gave that first view, I mean, it would be over. Like that would just be end of discussion. I would not get ordained. But for him, it's not a problem. Now he goes on to argue why he thinks that that's a wrong view, but he doesn't say there's one Reformed view and then you have some folk who call themselves Reformed, even though, you know, that they hold this view.
Yeah.
Rather, he considers it a Reformed view and just rejects it because he thinks it's unbiblical, which makes complete sense.
So. Sure. I want to go back and look at a principle that you suggested earlier was one of the drivers of this kind of specification that we see. And you talked about sort of regional churches, synods, how they receive it, how they receive things, what they're choosing to read,
mm-hmm.
how they're choosing to read it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's actually formalized in the principle of the animus impenitentis.
Yep.
So I'm hoping you can talk to our students a little bit about that and how that works. Because one thing I think one often finds is that people who do want to narrow things, I think, more than they have any warrant to, will say, well, this has been synodically decided, and of course there are no, you don't find any kind of ecumenically reformed synods that have determined most of these things that they think are determined.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So for instance, the Reformed Two Kingdoms people will say, well, look, you know, we're on the right, basically they'll say we're on the right side of history, I'm paraphrasing them, but we're glad it happened. We're glad the 18th century happened in the way that it did. We don't want the stuff about the civil magistrate, right? So we're just going to, that part of the Westminster tradition, we're just going to leave that. And the animus impenitentis is used to justify that kind of move. Can you talk a little bit about that, what that is, and how that works for our students?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, one of the principles that Hodge makes crystal clear in that article, actually, that I mentioned earlier, that he wrote, is that we get our interpretation of these confessional documents from history, right? We need to go back to the way that they understood it. We don't. We're trying to interpret the document in the way that they did. We're not trying to give. You know, it's not our interpretation of the document. Kind of. Regardless of how they may have interpreted and what they would have allowed and disallowed by their language,
right.
Rather, if we're going to continue to use documents that have an historical setting, Sitzenleben, then you know,
specified meaning.
Then we need to continue to look and do the work of history to determine what those meant in those contexts, and try to then apply that in our ordinations and everything else, in any sort of ecclesiastical affairs that we do. And if we don't like the judgment that they had, the issue isn't to kind of just jump to our own, well, we can just kind of reinterpret it as we like, but rather I think it's make new confessions then, which people were doing that all the time in the early modern period, and there may be good reason to do that, though again that would go back to whether or not I think we're capable of making better confessions than the ones that were written by these early modern folk who had, in my judgment, thought through things a lot more carefully than most of our ministers and even doctors.
Right.
So
let's talk a little bit about some of those moves that get made, like with the principle of the animus impenitus,
mm-hmm.
and maybe explain that to the students, what that actually means and how it functions. But it seems like often that kind of account is used to justify judgments which wind up being much more universal than the principle itself would warrant.
Mm-hmm.
When we say in the church, you know, the Presbyterian Churches of America, we receive the Westminster Confession in this way.
Mm-hmm.
So we've decided, you know, or the hypothetical we have, we decided to leave out the doctrine of the magistrate, and
mm-hmm.
we'll rework that. It seems like you would say, well, maybe we just write a new confession altogether. At the very least, maybe come clean about what's going on here.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that what often happened is that kind of peripheral move of reception, that so the things are being specified or changed by regional reception, will get elevated to a more universal thing. So now you can say, well, if you don't hold our modification,
yes,
you're not really reformed on this point anymore, because
yeah.
you know, history has moved on and we're not doing that.
Yeah, and I would say that sort of a move is just not a careful thinking through or assessing the reasons and motivations for why to use just the civil magistrate example, why it was that that the original language was what it was, and why they didn't like the idea of a civil magistrate calling synods and these sorts of things, and having that much power, I have no problem with them changing the language, but I think we need, as you put it, I think we need to be honest in saying that that's a modification that would have been universally understood as being probably not reformed,
right?
Like that modification is. We may say that it does not strike at the vitals of Reformed orthodoxy and these sorts of things, but the American shift there on the civil magistrate point, there's no one in the early modern period.
They would have thought it was crazy.
They would have thought it was crazy.
Which is not to say that we're not to agree with them either necessarily, but just to say it's a very serious.
They would have called it Anabaptist.
Right.
They would have just called it Anabaptist, which is about as worse as you could be called, except for being called a papist.
Or a Socinian.
Right? Or Socinian. Yeah, exactly.
Worse, yeah.
Socinian, papist, and then Anabaptist.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Sure.
I think that's just being careful and honest as an historian. I mean, honestly, I just don't think people are being careful and honest about the history. Part of it, again, goes back to the lack of a canon. Even those that want to speak authoritatively on church and state relationships, I won't name any names of those that have written books on two-kingdom relationship. I mean, how much are they reading of the actual early modern documents and the breadth of early modern documents that would touch exactly on that issue? I would suggest that they're probably not even able to get to the majority of those things. So they stick to English things that come to them in English. And so again, I just think, you know, and this is the Muller principle. Go back, read widely, read as much as you can before you start talking about this was the Reformed tradition and this was not allowed. You know, people like Heppy, you know, he's reading. He's reading a whole bunch of folk, right? Because he could. Today, we don't have folk, by and large, who are able to do that sort of thing. And so I think our understanding of confessionalization and then some of the modifications could be greatly helped by looking at the changes in the history of ideas. But the only way you're going to be able to do that is to be able to read those sources and note those changes and why those changes are going on. But we don't
so
have...
I mean, you're laying out kind of a program for the future, right? This is
yeah.
something that we ought to do.
Yeah.
Let me ask a question that pertains particularly to our students. Our students here are, as a general rule, quite competent readers of Latin. Some of them, I think, even expert readers of Latin. So the language isn't the primary barrier. Can you talk about the principles of reading besides just having Latin? Right, and of course, you know, enough Greek or whatever else was being
mm-hmm.
used. Can you talk about the principles of reading these texts so that you can understand them in their Sitzenleben and extract from them what is relevant for our time? So beyond just the hurdle of Latin, which most of these students have gotten very nicely over, what principles of reading ought they bring to bear? What principles of reading ought they to cultivate as they go deeper into this kind of the forgotten archive of Reformed theology?
Yeah, I think you would largely start off where any trained academic would have started off in the early modern period. You start with commonplaces, and then you bridge out to disputations and polemical treatises and other sorts of less well-known pieces of literature. But, you know, it's always going to be driven by people's interests. My interest is in Reformed soteriology, you know, really just the extent of the atonement. Like, I've had that niche, and so I just want to be an expert on that idea as it kind of moves from, you know, the beginnings of the early modern period through, actually, through almost the present. Folk in here are going to have all sorts of other interests in political theology and philosophy, and there is so much to be written and to be mined and to be rediscovered
right.
in those areas. And one of the things that both Muller and I have mentioned as being one of the reasons that we're so much into the early modern period is simply that we like to read people that we know are smarter than us.
And are interested in everything.
Yeah, they are humanists. They are Renaissance men in every sense of the term. And they're, you know, Baxter is having conversations with some of the finest scientists of his day, reading their works, commenting on their works, responding to them. He's just reading, and then he's having Sunday afternoon talks with who's that judge, that famous English Hale.
Wrote the treatise on the law of nature.
Yeah. He's literally reading everything, and most of these folk are reading
writing
widely.
On it, and that's a point I often make to students that what you're looking at, I think it's almost better to call it Reformed wisdom, because they wrote theological treatises, but the same guy who's writing a great theological treatise, you think of him as a theologian, he's probably written poetry, he's written a tractate on poetry, he's written
yeah.
on gardening, he might have written
yeah.
a manual on fencing. I mean, you
yeah.
never know with these people.
Right.
And it is really a faith for all of life that they applied to all of life.
Sure.
And if you just focus in on the theological loci that they published, you'll get a very distorted view of what these guys were about. You'll imagine them as these sorts of nerdy eggheads of the 17th century,
mm-hmm.
and that this is all they're doing is, you know, making sure that the language of the Trinity is exactly right, which we should be immensely concerned about. But these men were actually, they had a life.
Their
Reformed faith informed all of it. And so there's a whole wealth of text to look at to see, well, how did our fathers in faith live? It's not simply the theology.
Yeah, if you go to Post-Reformation Digital Library, if it's PRDL, and you go to the Scholastica section, which has different universities and their faculties divided And you can see the law faculty, and you could see, you know, theology faculty, and art faculty, or and if you click on some of those names that have a lot of published works that are available either on Google Books or Internet Archives, what you'll often find is that, you know, some you know, he was professor of law at, you know, the University of Wittenberg or something like that. Will have written a theological disputation.
Yeah, sure.
Will have given a theological disputation. You're sitting here thinking to yourself, do you know of any lawyers that are regularly doing academic disputations on Christology or Trinitarianism or something like that, right? Like these guys, they were not one-trick ponies, as I often call myself. I only know, like, one thing, and that's early modern Reformed Orthodoxy. Don't ask me about politics, because I don't, yeah. I can't keep
I
up.
I mean, before we sort of make ourselves despair by measuring ourselves against these titans, it is worth pointing out that the age of disciplinarity in all of its mm-hmm. ramifications had not yet dawned.
Yes.
There's more to being a lawyer now than there was then.
Indeed.
There's more to being a theologian now.
Yes,
but I still
indeed.
Think that kind of interdisciplinarity grounded in a classical liberal arts education is something that's achievable.
Yes.
We've gone so far in the other direction, and we can't just use disciplinarity or specification as an excuse to not be polymath at some
yes.
kind of generalistic level.
Yes.
And so I think there is an ideal there. But I want to talk about your niche, because that's really... That's what you're kind of famous for, is that hot pepper doctrine. There, you've done a lot of historical research on hypothetical universalism, which makes a lot of people nervous. You know, I think Richard Muller has given his own sort of imprimatur to say, well, this was actually no part of. It was an acceptable opinion within mm-hmm. the broad historical orthodoxy, although never a majority position in any kind of codified way.
Yeah.
You just find there are periods where a lot more people are holding it than you might think. And one thing that was a shock to me when I first was doing this kind of historical work many years ago was I had figured it out about a guy like Davenant. And, you know, I could see the difference between Davenant and Amiot. But it was some of the later people in the 19th century that I discovered much later.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was floored, because I thought that the door had been closed much earlier than that. So can you talk about your expertise, hypothetical universalism, as a historical study, what it is, who held it and why, what was at stake, and what is its afterlife?
Yeah, so, I mean, here's...
And I promise not to ask if you believe it.
Yeah, okay, yeah, don't. I like wearing the history hat.
There you go. You got your history hat on.
Yeah, so, especially this is getting recorded, so...
There it is.
Yeah,
It's the orthodoxometer.
So the very first kind of this is the basic, like, older literature typically didn't really differentiate between hypothetical universalisms. It would just talk about hypothetical universalism, and when you would go.
And what do you mean by older literature?
Yeah, older literature. I'm talking about everything like basically pre 2000. Yeah, I mean,
I think you also mean post something too.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, yeah, I'd say once post the early modern period is basically what I would say is, you know, when Reformed Orthodoxy wanes, and people are no longer interested in reading the variety of Reformed Orthodoxy. What you end up happening is this canon shrinking, and then people maybe just reading Turretin or you know, someone later as well, or Owen, and kind of deciding that that's Reformed. And then when they might come across someone like an Amiot, they're like, this is not anywhere near what Owen was saying or what in Turretin seemed to actually be going against, what this Amiot fella, you know, seeming to think it's unorthodox. And so they just immediately pigeonhole it as unorthodox. And then when they'll find, then they, you know, maybe they come across, John Davenant or Bishop Usher, and they say, oh, this sounds a lot like this Amiot fellow. So they say he's kind of, you know, this guy must have been, these must have been like precursors to that, and kind of heading in this kind of non-reformed,
slippery slope to liberalism.
Of course, yeah. You know, like so historians today that, you know, write on hypothetical universalism, the three of us,
And let's explain what that is for everyone.
That we want to distinguish between two traditions. Usually the two traditions that are distinguished nowadays is English hypothetical universalism and French Amiroldianism or Amiroldism. And the term hypothetical universalism seems to have come out of that French tradition. And there's even diversity there in trying to define it. I'm actually not an expert on French Amiroldianism, but the basic issue going on there is that they wanted to argue that they had their own ordering of the decrees in which the sending of Christ in that ordering of the one decree of God comes previous to the determination of predestination, basically, right? Such that you have the sending of Christ to make propitiation for all or to be mediator for all, and then election results after first wanting to be a savior of all. You're savior of, you know, there's kind of a general love of God, wishing God to be savior of all men, but of course, people need effectual grace, and so predestination comes in afterwards. The French Amiroldians were Calvinists in the sense of they held to absolute predestination, but they liked to emphasize this general common love towards all humanity. The thing about the French Amiroldians that people don't often recognize is it actually wasn't their view on the extent of the atonement that got people all riled up. That was one of many different issues that they were tinkering with in the later kind of 17th century that people were really getting frustrated with, including the question of whether or not general revelation was sufficient for the salvation of those that didn't hear about, who couldn't hear about Christ, or even, you know, Louis Capel, who's a French Amiroldian, he was at the Saumur and was a colleague of Amirose. You know, he's arguing that the Hebrew vowel points are uninspired. Now, at that time, given the normal view that they, you know, are ancient, you know, maybe Ezra's time or something like that, sounds liberal. It sounds liberal, and it seems like you're attacking the authority of Scripture itself if you say that these vowel points are uninspired. And so if we put ourselves in the mind of like a Turretin, we can see how you would think to yourself, these guys are just off their rockers, and they're liberalizing. So there's all of that. Then there is what's called English hypothetical universalism, which is what I really kind of have, that's my specialty. And it arose, that particular view arose in conversations that were going on with Lutherans, Hebraism in particular, and Remonstrants with regard to the sufficiency and the efficacy of Christ's death. So, you know, there's this long scholastic tradition of if you were asked the question, you know, for whom did Christ die, the natural answer was the Lombardian formula, right? Sufficient for all, efficient for the elect. And you know, it's called the Lombardian formula, but it goes back way long before Lombard. They thought it actually went all the way back to Ambrose, but that's because they thought that Call of the Gentiles was written by Ambrose, when in reality it was written by probably Prosper, who was an Augustinian. And so, anyways, all that to say is that the formula kind of goes back for a long time, and that just kind of was the standard way of talking. No Reformed theologian in the first part of the 16th century, you know, say till like 1660, 1670, had any problem talking about the sufficiency of Christ's death, even talking about Christ being the savior of the 15. Whole world. 15, yes, I just said 16, yeah, 15, you know, to 1560-ish, you know, 1570, had no problem talking about Christ being the Savior of the world, what they would have meant was he's the Savior of the world in terms of the sufficiency of Christ, that he was sent for all men such that, you know, the gospel offer could be given to them, and that if they believe, they'd be saved. That was no problem. In fact, Musculus has a section on universal redemption in his commonplaces, and you think to yourself, is he going against it? It's in his commonplaces on universal redemption. Is he going against it? No, he's arguing for it. And he's arguing for this basic sufficiency of how Christ's death is sufficient for all men, and it's called universal redemption. But because of hubrism, Lutheran, this particularly well-known Lutheran who is arguing that Christ's death basically justified all human beings, and that then, you know, if so long as you didn't kind of reject that Christ's death or something like that for yourself, you would always be justified, such that a pagan child who's born and who dies in infancy, he would have been justified. Why? Because he had no opportunity to reject the death of Christ. And so, you know, Huber's saying all these sorts of things, and Reformed are going nuts on Huber. You know, Huber, this is kind of lost in the whole narrative. Everyone always talks about the Reformed going after the Remonstrants, but the Reformed saw the Remonstrants' view on the extent of the atonement largely as a it's basically hubrism all over again. This is what Kim Adonkius, in fact, and some of these German theologians, Ursinus and...
Real guy, Kim Adonkius.
Yeah, Kim Adonkius. He's a well-known Reformed theologian in the late 16th century. He was at Heidelberg with Ursinus. He writes a book on the universality of the death of Christ, or something, or on the universal redemption of Christ, or something like that. The title is something like that. Anyways, and he's arguing against hubrism, basically. And these Lutherans who are trying to argue that Christ's death was actually effectual for all human beings. But of course, its effectuality is lost if people reject it and these sorts of things. And then if they come back to it, its effectuality is given back to them. You know, they're now redeemed again and non-redeemed, and then they can be redeemed back again. And these sorts of things, because you can lose your justification, gain it all over again. These sorts of things. So he's going hard after that. But in that milieu, in that theological kind of world, you have some theologians who start saying, listen, this whole Lombardian business of sufficiency and efficacy, let's just simplify it. Christ came to die and give himself for the elect. And let's just leave it at that. And there's this kind of pendulum swing in that direction, such that Piscator in 1612, Piscator, yes, the famous guy who denied the imputation of active obedience of Christ, the imputation of it.
They don't know.
Oh, you don't know.
they're probably still wrestling with Kim Adonkius.
Yeah.
as a name.
So there's this guy, Johann Piscator, who, is he Dutch? Yes, he's Dutch. He wasn't like Swiss or French, so. I think he was Dutch. I don't know, Piscator. What does that sound like? I don't know. Anyways, Piscator, he's a well-known, well-read, he wrote commentaries on all sorts of the Bible. By the way, that's a whole other world that's lost. These guys, we think to yourselves, you know, you think to yourselves, all these guys are just interested in scholastic disputations on all these, like, finer points of theology, like hypothetical universalism. No, most of these guys wrote massive commentaries on a whole range of biblical books, all of which are in Latin, all of which are basically lost to us unless they were translated, right?
Anyway.
Huh? Unless you know Latin, and then in which case you should actually go read some of these things. Anyways, Piscator, he's the first one that I know who just flat out says, I deny that the death of Christ is sufficient for all human beings. That doesn't make any sense. It either redeemed them or it didn't. There's no idea of sufficiency going on here. If it was sufficient to redeem them, it would have redeemed them. Hence, it wasn't sufficient if it didn't redeem them. And he just flat out, he calls the Lombardian formula an inane distinction. He thinks that it's contradictory in its very terms. And it's in that world that the hypothetical universalists arise, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to recover that original medieval and even early modern view that was just standard fare for Reformed and Roman Catholic and Lutheran and everyone else view of the sufficiency and efficacy of Christ's death. And, so that there's a sense in which we can say that Christ died for all men, and there's a sense in which we say that Christ died only for the elect. And those senses are with regard to the sufficiency and efficacy of Christ's death. He died sufficiently for all men and efficaciously for the elect alone. And
this survives a long time after Piscator, right? So can you give us some surprising examples right. of how late it survives?
So, I mean, this view, Davin and Usher are explicitly teaching it, writing on it. It's Croxius Burgius in Germany are writing on it explicitly to other well-known, they would have been the most well-known German Reformed theologians in the time period of like Dort and later. Both of them were actually Dortian delegates. Taught by Baxter, of course, but even like folk like John Howe, Matthew Henry. Matthew Henry is a hypothetical universalist. Some of these later
19th century characters.
Yeah. In the 19th century, the view promulgated by Robert Louis Dabney, I think by Charles Hodge, and some other less well known folk like James Richards, who wrote a tract on it published by the Presbyterian Board of Publication. In like 1838 or something like that. I mean, they're all arguing for what Davenant would have seen to be his own position, I think, by and large. Dabney, most explicitly, had a whole controversy with Benjamin Morgan Palmer, a Southern Presbyterian, on the exact topic, and Palmer was stunned. He said he felt like he was at a funeral when he read what Dabney's view on the extent of the atonement was. When he read it, he said he felt like he was at a gravesite because his heart sank, because he could not believe that Dabney basically held to what in Palmer's mind was amiroldianism. That was completely outside the bounds, because of course in the 19th century in America, there's only amiroldianism, and it's all bad. Because you've read Turretin.
No one remembers.
Because that's what, that's what Turretin has taught you. And
nobody remembers English hypothetical.
Yeah. No one had read really Davenant, or they had read Baxter, and, Owen, goes after Baxter enough. And Baxter had some other peculiarities such that he's kind of a guy that you wouldn't want on your side anyways by the 19th
century. Everyone loves him. You don't want to think exactly like him.
Exactly.
Well, then let's wrap up with that. Go ahead and do that. Thank you again, Dr. Lynch.
New St. Andrews College, thanks you for listening.